Welcome to the HACOMI Global Summit, an international gathering of today's leading HACOMI experts integrating mindfulness, loving presence, and embodied psychology into the fields of personal growth and transformation. We appreciate you sharing this information with your community. You can also join the conversation on Facebook at The Shift Network. And now your host, Rob Fisher.
Welcome to the HACOMI Global Summit, a production of the Shift Network. I'm Rob Fisher, and we're so glad that you're joining us. I'm very excited to introduce our special guest today, Donna Martin. Donna is from Kamloops, British Columbia, another country. And she's been a therapist and a yoga teacher for many years, a stress management consultant and an addictions counselor, and an international HACOMI practitioner and trainer since the mid-90s. She travels all over the world. She worked very closely with Ron Kurtz, who's the founder of HACOMI, over the last 20 years of his life, and co-authored with him The Practice of Loving Presence, which is now available as an e-book. You can get it at www.hacomi.ca, as in Canada. And she's also co-authored Seeing Your Life with New Eyes with Paul Brenner, MD, and wrote a chapter in the recently released book on HACOMI. That's a different one, a chapter about HACOMI, a book called Inner Dialogue in Daily Life. But you also wrote one in the recent book that was released,
yes.
Donna.
Yes. Mindfulness-centered somatic psychotherapy.
Yes, that's just come out like last week or a week before that. And other ones, too. Your trainings with Ron Kurtz were called Higher Ground Psychotherapy as Spiritual Practice, which I think is a very interesting idea, particularly because I wrote my master's thesis on that, so maybe we could talk about that a little bit. And you also have your own original approach called Soma Yoga Therapy. And you're semi-retired, but you're still writing and teaching in beautiful places only, and I think playing with your grandchildren. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. So, yeah, I was thinking about how to introduce you and introduce loving presence, and I thought that loving presence is really the heart of psychotherapy. And I thought, I'll go to her website, and that's what's in the middle of her website, the heart of psychotherapy. And it's the essence of that defines the healing relationship and how we're really approaching working with people, and so far beyond and deeper than all the wonderful techniques that we teach, and so important. So I'm really glad to be talking with you about it, and thought we could start out a little bit with kind of just defining what is this loving presence stuff, and maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think it's kind of surprising to people to even suggest that we need to be aware of a state of mind called loving presence as therapists or as helpers. I mean, it just sounds obvious. But there's something really unusual about what we mean by loving presence and what Ron Kurtz had in mind when he coined the term, and that is a little bit of a radical idea that as therapists, our first task is to find something about the client and something about the whole experience of being present with someone that way that's nourishing for us. It's about opening and to receiving inspiration and what we call nourishment, non-egocentric nourishment, from the experience of being with somebody and from the a certain way of seeing them. So it's kind of radical in the sense of it seeming like my first task is to take care of myself.
Yes, it seems very un-American.
Well, I'm a Canadian. There you go.
Yeah, well, that's why.
even more radical for Canadians.
Uh-huh. So you mentioned non-egocentric nourishment. What does that mean exactly? What kind of nourishment is non-egocentric? How is that different from going down to 7-Eleven getting a big gulp?
What we mean by non-egocentric is we're not being nourished by anything that feels like ego, that feels like that I can take credit for it. So it's the same, in a way, it's the same kind of nourishment that happens when we look at a beautiful sunset. Whereas if I look at the photograph I took of the beautiful sunset, I'll feel good about that too. But it's a little bit more ego involved. But when I see the beautiful sunset, there's a sense of grace. There's a sense of just pure gratitude of being blessed by something that had nothing to do with me, that had nothing to do with me deserving it or taking credit for it. And there's a way of seeing others like this, which I think is very natural if we are with our grandchildren, for example, or see a small baby or a little puppy. It happens kind of spontaneously then. But to consider the possibility that we can actually have a practice that allows that feeling of being nourished by being with anybody to arise spontaneously, because not because of something we're doing in the moment, but because of something that's been set up by a practice that we do, that can happen instantly with clients, with strangers, with people that we see on the bus, and it's an amazing experience. And when it happens with a client, whether we say anything directly about our experience or not, the client picks it up. The client feels in our presence seen and honored, respected, even loved.
Mm-hmm. So it's even bigger than just the realm of psychotherapy or really any of the healing arts. You're talking about a way of approaching people wherever you go.
Well, in a way, it's the heart of why this is the spiritual practice. The psychotherapy and being with somebody as a helper, as a therapist, or as any kind of helping professional is just one small part of a whole attitude to experiencing life as if each moment is a gift. And that, to me, is the heart of the spiritual practice.
Mm-hmm. Well, what if somebody's grumpy? What if they're not experiencing this moment as a gift? They're angry at their friend for standing them up for dinner, or they just got a big bill for re-roofing their office building, or whatever it is that, you know, that disturbs our state of equanimity. What do they do to kind of find their way back to loving presence?
You know, here's where the Hakomi method comes in as the savior for me, anyway. And it's really timely that you ask me that. Why? What if somebody is grumpy? Well, I came to this call 20 minutes ago feeling pretty grumpy because the person that was bringing me to this place, where I'm making the call from, was late. And so I was concerned. I got grumpy at him for not making this a priority. So I came in the state of mind you're talking about. And, I mean, we all do that. I cut myself some slack because I know these feelings get triggered in me as they do in anyone. And I'm so grateful for the years of Hakomi that have helped me do what I think is a practice also in my life that I help others with by teaching them basically the practice. And that is, first of all, I mean, you know this, the first thing is notice what's happening. The difference between having a reaction and noticing I'm having a reaction. I'm still having the reaction, but noticing I'm having the reaction, and then sort of inhabiting the the space of awareness around the reaction. That difference is huge. It gives me... It gives me a kind of a pause, a space, a gap between what's getting triggered in me and how to act or react. And we talk about the difference between a response and a reaction. And I think of it as very simply as the difference between being, you know, in a knee-jerk reaction, on automatic, doing something because it's habitual and I'm programmed for it in a way, and a response is I can have the same feelings coming up. I can be triggered in the same way, but I have this space around it where I'm noticing what's happening, and I'm also aware of a number of possibilities of what to do with it. And I make a choice in the moment based on the conditions of the present moment and what actually will work best. So that, for me, is the difference between a reaction and a response, and is probably the ultimate gift we give our clients using Hakomi.
So there's that space then between the experience and the reaction that really, you're talking about mindfulness there, that you, there's this moment where you can kind of step back a little bit from your experience and say, oh, I'm feeling grumpy, you know, I'm having these kind of beliefs about, you know, my friend being irresponsible. I was in a really similar situation a few days ago where somebody stood me up to for a hike. You know, and if I'm sitting in my car, you know, I've been grumpy. And then I started studying the grumpiness, you know, like, yeah. So interesting. Like, I'm grumpy, and I'm starting to think they don't care about my time, they don't care about me, they don't care about our relationship. And I think about the specific person, and I think, like, I'm absolutely wrong. They'll be horrified when they know that they stood me up. But I can watch my mind unfolding and my attachment to things being on time, which is a very Western idea, and my idea that it is somehow wrong for them to be late. And by the time I finished watching all, you know, this wonderful play of kind of beliefs, I thought, well, you know, I could get out of my car and I could take the walk on my own. I watched the whales jumping out of the ocean and the blackberries on the bushes which went into my mouth. But I think where people often get stuck is once you notice this and you notice the workings of your own grumpiness, for instance, like with the experience you just had, like, how do you go from there? There's this moment of like a breath between the reaction and kind of taking any action where you can kind of notice yourself. But then how do you get back into some kind of loving presence from there? Is there another step?
Yeah, great. Your example is wonderful because you talk about also from your own practice and your background and mindfulness and Hakomi of not just noticing the grumpiness, but noticing the story you're telling yourself, you know, and the difference between believing something and realizing you're telling yourself a story. That's a huge difference right there. And then you talked about something that I think is the spiritual practice. It's how is what exactly what's happening a gift for you? Is there a gift? I mean, and it sounds kind of new agey and flaky, but it's an action that you took to get out of the car, to look at, you know, what's beautiful around you, to savor what's actually being offered to you in the moment. That's one huge part of it. But there's another part of it that has really become my focus, and it's mainly because of my background as a yoga teacher and practitioner. Every reaction we have, every experience we're having, is embodied. And when I'm having a reaction, if I notice I'm grumpy, I mean, none of what I'm going to talk about or what you talked about is possible without that witnessing, that self-reflection. So as soon as we have that, that feels to me like the biggest gift we give people by using Hakomi. is this moment where I go, oh, I realize I'm grumpy. I'm feeling grumpy. And then there might be an insight about a belief or the story or what I'm thinking. What I am learning to do and starting to do with clients is direct attention to how am I embodying that. It's absolutely impossible to be having a reaction without an embodied contraction, probably a way of using our breath. There's probably a facial expression. There's a posture. It's almost like it's a yoga posture that goes with grumpy. You know, and I could sometimes what I'll ask a client to do once they realize they're in a certain reaction is especially if they have a yoga background, but even if they don't, I say, well, imagine that you're teaching me how to embody this. You know, just study what all you're doing bodily that sustains this grumpy feeling. And there'll be multiple components to it. The focus, the shift of focus to how am I embodying this feeling does two things. First of all, it gives us awareness of the body part of it, which is something that we can actually interrupt. But yes, it also just moves us from the grumpy feeling, if that's what it is, to curiosity. And that shift to curiosity is the shift to the witness. The witness without curiosity could go into judgment. But with curiosity, it's, oh, okay, oh, what am I doing with my face? Oh, what's happening in my jaw? Oh, I'm noticing I'm holding my, you know, all of the things I begin to notice. It's so important to realize that shift to a state of mind of curiosity is almost more important than whatever we find out about our body. But the act of studying the embodied reaction, not just the thoughts and the story, really becomes the doorway to choice. As you know, the whole point of this method is based on discovery and self-discovery and using mindfulness to become aware of something, because consciousness brings choice, and choice is freedom.
And the body is such a good playground for that, because often people don't experience having much choice of the mental loops which go through their brains. You know, nobody cares about me, or, you know, I'm not wanted here, whatever, I'm not good enough, things like that tend to loop in the brain. And those are very hard to interrupt, but if you notice that you're scrunching up your face, or you're only taking little breaths rather than breathing more deeply, then there's the possibility of actually taking some action to change those, or to find out what, if there are messages in them also, then you can begin to have some choice. And I think the part, introducing that, the component of the body is so powerful there.
Right, I think so too. And I think there's a really important next step which Hakomi uses, and I know that it comes from Ron having studied with Moshe Feldenkrais, and I've also studied some Feldenkrais and used Feldenkrais principles in the way I teach Hakomi as well as the way I teach yoga. And that is, it might seem obvious to you, but it's very paradoxical for many people to realize that when we notice that we're doing something, for example, tightening the jaw, let's say, that's part of our embodied reaction, the next step is not to try to release the jaw. The next step is to study how we're tightening the jaw. Maybe even do it on purpose, maybe even slightly exaggerate it, and get so fascinated with the tightening of the jaw that we learn something about it. whether we learn anything cognitively, we become aware, if nothing else, of the fact that it's I who am tightening my jaw. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's not my jaw isn't doing it to me. My tension
right.
isn't because of my stress. If I study and actually take charge of the tightening I'm noticing that inevitably is a part of the embodied reaction I'm having, if I notice that I'm doing it and then take charge of it, I'll learn something about it, certainly, but I'm mainly reminding myself that it's me that's doing it. If it's me that's doing it, I can choose to do it or not do it. But if I try
right.
to stop doing it without that awareness of who's after all doing it, it becomes an inner conflict. And so the difference
yes.
between noticing what's happening and trying to change it, on the one hand, which is an old approach, or noticing what's happening and getting fascinated with it and actually making it intentional and making it voluntary, that's a huge and paradoxical way of working for many people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really allowing people to take ownership of how they engineer their own experiences. And it often becomes invisible to all of us how we think that the outside world is doing it to us more than that we're somehow participating in creating our own experiences.
Yeah, exactly.
But let's go back to loving presence. I want to go back to loving presence here. So how do you teach this thing? Like, you know, how to, given that people often go through their lives in less than loving present states, how do you train people? And, you know, in Hakomi, I know we do. Like, what are some of the ways that's actually trained? Because is that something that's trainable? And if so, how?
Right. You know, and it fits with some of what we've been talking about, because the very first step in the practice is self-awareness, is noticing what's happening already. I love a quote by Moshe Feldenkrais, who said, "You cannot do what you want until you know what you're already doing." And I was teaching a loving presence workshop one time with about 30 absolute beginners. Only one or two people had had any Hakomi, and nobody had been to a loving presence workshop. And so we did some of the practices, which I'll describe in a moment. And the people came the second day on the Sunday morning, and one woman said, "You know, I kind of get this whole thing about loving presence now that you've pointed at it and we've had some experience of it with almost everybody. But I've got this guy at work that's just a total jerk. You know, how do I get into loving presence with him?" Well, again, it's kind of paradoxical, the answer to that. It's not how do you get into loving presence with somebody. It's noticing you're not and then studying what is coming up. And the starting place is always noticing what's happening now. So the very first step, I mean, it's what Hakomi is about, and the focus is on presence and being mindful of ourselves, and the big importance, I guess, of the word presence in loving presence is that the very first thing we need to do is notice what's happening now with ourselves, what's arising.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing is what we were talking about is shifting to curiosity. I think we're so programmed in our culture to noticing ourselves critically. You know, I notice that I'm doing something and I have a judgment about it. Trying not to do that just creates more judgment. So
mm-hmm.
the antidote to judgment is curiosity. And
that's nicely put.
So the pardon me?
That's nicely put. The antidote to judgment is curiosity.
As soon as I am aware of something that seems like a habit that's been unconscious and I get fascinated with it, I love using that word with people, get fascinated, get curious enough about it that you discover something new. That shift to that state of mind creates an opening. We call the first step in the practice of loving presence self-awareness, and the second step we call spacious mind. And there's a number of tricks to creating spacious mind, but one of them, and one of the easiest, is curiosity. Curiosity opens a space to, you put it this way a few moments ago, to stand back and look at what's happening. Just that sort of step back creates a bit of separation from it and some space around it. And the curiosity is open-hearted. You know, the curiosity is what in Buddhism is called maitri. It's a friendly interest in ourselves. It's, like watching a butterfly and getting fascinated with the way it moves its wings and how it moves from flower to flower. And every habit that we notice can attract that kind of curiosity if we have that intention. We think of the whole method, and certainly the approach with loving presence is one of self-discovery. And so starting with self-awareness, and then so I notice what's happening now, what's coming up in me. If I have this guy at work that's a jerk, what's being triggered in me? And that whole process we talked about a few moments ago of studying our embodied reaction, that's the first step, and getting really curious about it and opening some space around it. If it's a client that comes in and I notice that there's, you know, a reaction I'm having or a judgment I'm having, or even an old habit of looking for what's wrong or what's the pattern here that we might be working on, or just whatever's a habitual way of seeing, we want to create an openness and a spaciousness around even that, so that we can move into the third step, which we call seeing differently, is the simple way to put it, or even perceptual wisdom is one way Ron Kurtz called it. Perceptual wisdom is being willing to look behind and beyond what's on the surface. I know what I'm seeing on the surface by the reaction that gets triggered. So how to look differently. You know how in Hakomi we talk about seeing the storyteller, paying more attention to the storyteller than the story. And it's yes, even more. There's a cover story. You know, there's the storyteller, his or her presenting image. And then there's what's going on behind that. And, of course, that's what our curiosity is as a therapist, but in any situation in life, we can use that shift to notice the initial reaction I'm having to somebody, to notice what it is I'm seeing, to get curious about what else is there or what's behind that, and open some space around it, and then see behind or beneath the surface. And if we're doing that, the fourth step is almost spontaneous. The fourth step is the one we call non-egocentric nourishment. We can be intentional about it, and one of the practices we do over and over again in our Hakomi training is what we call search for inspiration. We can do it having the person walk toward us and not say anything, you know, and we just search for what do we imagine, even, let alone what do we see or perceive about the person, that when I notice it, I feel inspired. So we can actually intentionally put on that lens and look for that. And it feels like a really important way of seeing any new client that comes in, or even a client that's been coming week after week, is to be able to put on a lens and look through a filter that's actually designed to see something new and inspiring. And then the last step that happens with that in the loving presence practice sequence is we call it loving presence. It's not something we do. It's if we've done all those steps, we've noticed what's happening on automatic, we get curious and create some openness and space around it, we decide to look more deeply and particularly look for something inspiring. And then we feel inspired and we feel nourished in some way by something about the person that might be it might be, you know, courage or vulnerability or just the beauty of the person or some characteristic that we're appreciating. Could even be something we're imagining. It doesn't matter because it's our state of mind we're shifting. And that last stage is loving presence. It's interesting. It's really intentionally filling up with it. You know, like digesting a really good meal, like savoring the taste of something delicious, but also just really letting it nourish us deeply and trusting that if I'm in a state of really intentionally and consciously feeling nourished by being with someone, that'll show in some way. I don't need to speak about it. It'll show in some way that the other person will feel. And the other person, the client, perhaps, or whoever the other person is that we're being with, on some level, it might even be unconscious, realizes that they're being appreciated. They actually can see a mirror in a way of their own beauty and their own strength. It's the most powerful gift we give anyone.
As well as giving it to ourselves. I mean, it's very much like a gratefulness practice, and it has some similarities to compassion practices, which are not just for the other person, but for ourselves, because people feel better when they're in a state of inspiration and gratefulness and compassion than they do when they're in grumpy states.
Absolutely, absolutely. That was well put, too. Can I just read you a quote of Ron's that I have at the beginning of one of my writings?
Yes.
For me, it's a really clear description in two sentences of why we think of this as a spiritual practice. And he wrote this: being in a calm, clear, loving state of mind is a spiritual practice, a path to liberation. Between two or more people, it creates a sacred space in which everyone is nourished, a space which is the heart of healing. Ron had a nice
That's
way
very
with
nice.
Words.
He did have a nice way with words. Yeah, that really summarizes it beautifully.
There's
yeah,
another
you're creating
quote
a kind of
sometimes.
You're creating really a you're creating a sacred relationship there, which brings out the best in both people.
Yeah, it's a healing for both, isn't it? Do you know what I'm talking about? It's interesting that the focus in the practice of loving presence and the focus of our training isn't first of all on how to nourish and help the other person. It's our primary task is first of all to feel nourished ourselves, to take care of ourselves, and that's the idea that's a little bit radical. But when people have the experience of it, when they have the experience of both ends of it, which we do in our trainings, of course, then it's so obvious how much that the state of mind of the helper influences the state of the person being helped. So if the helper, if the therapist is feeling loving, is feeling appreciative, is feeling nourished, is feeling like you know, they're blessed by the whole opportunity to be with you, then you as the client are incredibly nourished by that, and it becomes a loop, a reciprocal loop. It becomes a feedback loop. The more you feel appreciated by the therapist, the more you open and get vulnerable and reveal yourself, and the more that happens, this feels even more nourished. So it's a wonderful continuous loop that occurs. You still there?
Yes, it's the yes, I am. That's the cycle of generosity.
Yes. Yeah.
I think we have enough time. If you want, I'm wondering if you would be willing to just lead us and people who are listening in, like in just very brief, like a 3-minute exercise that might help us enter that kind of cycle of inspiration and generosity.
Sure. You know, there's, if I come back to the question that the person asked in that workshop, you know, what do I do about that person that that triggers me, that person, I can feel loving with all the people in this workshop and a lot of the people I know, but what about this guy at work, you know? And we've all got somebody like that. And at least most of us do. Ron would say, if you don't, get out of here. if you can call up somebody that you have had recently or typically have a reaction to that is difficult or challenging in some way, so that you're actually thinking of somebody in particular. And you know, if we were doing this in a group and you were doing it in pairs, I would say don't ever speak about who that is. You don't ever have to tell the person you're working with who you're thinking about or describe them even, because that's not what we're doing. But we're using the experience of being triggered by somebody who's challenging for us or by a recent experience, something that happened that you have, you know, you can still tell you have a reaction to. So just think about it long enough. Our brain is wonderful. Our nervous system's going to generate the same reaction that we had in the actual experience. So we're only thinking about it long enough to begin to notice the reaction. There'll be a feeling, which might be anger, might be irritation or sadness or frustration or impatience or whatever the feeling is. Get curious about the embodied aspect of that. Where is there a tightness that happens that goes with that? Just get curious. You might have to keep going back to thinking about the person or the experience, the incident, and come back to what gets triggered bodily. We're not going to work with each place because there may be more than one part of your body, obviously, that is part of this whole pattern of reaction. But just notice different places. Maybe there's a facial expression that starts to happen, or a change in your breathing, or a tightness somewhere in your belly or somewhere else in your body. So we're just kind of taking stock of what happens. And we still have that. We're not forgetting about the person, even when we shift our attention to our bodily experience. And so we're just sort of noticing it all. There's a whole other way of going more deeply into that and finding out more about it. But we won't do that just now. We're just going to notice that we're having an embodied reaction. Then we take a breath. And just release the breath. There's no way of having a reaction to something without it impacting our breathing. I learned that as a yoga teacher. So we're just going to take a big breath, and the breath is part of the way that we can create space. Another way to move into spacious mind, that's the next stage, is to get curious. And get curious about the person. call up the person again. Get curious about what are they thinking? What might they have been like as a five-year-old? That's a really useful one for me because I helped my kids when they were five. I helped in the kindergarten class. I can picture anyone as a five-year-old. And I can see vulnerability when I can do that. Any way of looking at the person more deeply. And then what I'm actually going to do is call up the image of the person, and admittedly there's something about them that evoked this reaction. What is there if I search for it? It's not to deny the characteristic or the behavior that triggered me. It's what is there that's beautiful or inspiring? There might actually be a strength in the behavior, an upside to that, or it might be something completely different. You know, the person is late and it seems disrespectful, but there's something else about them that I can see. I'm going to actually search for inspiration. But the next step is really important. That is, if I can see something, or even if I'm just searching for inspiration, what changes in my embodied reaction? It might be one thing, might be the breath, might be one place that was tight begins to soften. When I see or search for inspiration in the other, what happens in my embodied experience? And then my attention comes back to that, and I'll just rest there. I'll just rest with the experience of something softening or letting go or the breath changes. And then if I can stabilize that new state and look at the person again or call up the person again, I think the experience will be different. That was kind of fast.
Yes, it was a little fast. We don't have that much time, but you went through all those stages. And one of the things that's so nice about that is you're not doing a spiritual bypass. You're including the body in it, and you're including the difficult experiences, and then you're actually helping people to shift into a more preferred experience.
Yeah, great. I'm glad you pointed that out. It's not by talking myself into trying to be loving at all. Mm-hmm. It's by actually changing the way I'm perceiving and embodying the experience of the other person so that there's a spontaneous shift. I'm not talking
right.
myself out of my reaction at all. Yeah, that's a good point. You know, there's a wonderful quote by Sharon Salzberg that I almost always include in any talk about loving presence, because I think she summed it up beautifully. She said, she's a Buddhist teacher, and she wrote a wonderful book called Loving Kindness. And she said, the simple act of being completely present to another person, is truly an act of love. No drama is required. I love that last part. It's about, what's in the way of me being completely present in an open-hearted way to another person is the curiosity that I have about myself. And so that we don't have to generate being loving. There's something, love is a natural state. And if we're not in loving presence with somebody, we're doing something else. What else are we doing? And can we get fascinated with that and explore and experiment with that until it falls away and we're back to our natural state, which is loving presence?
Yes. Well, I hear the friendliness and the curiosity in that, and as opposed to opposition and trying to manipulate yourself into some other state. And Really is, I think, that combined with the use of mindfulness and the use of the resources of the body really present a nice, very complete package of how do you move into loving presence with people. I particularly appreciated hearing the whole exercise, and I think that would be very useful to people who are listening here. So I want to thank you for spending this time with me and the people who are listening, and I hope everybody comes and listens to future sessions with our speakers, and thank you again, Donna, for coming and enjoy the greenery of the northern sections of this world, and hope to talk to you again soon.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you, Rob. Thanks so much. I know how much you naturally understand this whole loving presence thing as well as Hakomi, so it's been a joy to have this dialogue with you. Thank you.
Thank you. That's very nice. If you'd like to get any more information about what Donna is up to, her workshops and loving presence, you can find that on www.hakomi.ca, and that's www.hakomi.ca. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for the Hakomi Global Summit, brought to you by the Shift Network. For more information about joining our global community of people awakening to their divine humanity and taking inspired action, visit theshiftnetwork.com. To learn more about the entire Hakomi Global Summit collection of teachers, or to add all these sessions to your personal library, visit hakomiglobal.com/upgrade. We hope you'll share the summit with your friends and family. We appreciate your dedicated support.